Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you.
Hello, and welcome to episode 289 of Dogcast Radio, which is all about guardian livestock dogs with expert Dr. Linda Van Bommel. Later, I'll be bringing you an express version of the Dogcast Radio news, 5 dog news stories in 5 minutes. But before that, let's get straight into guardian livestock dogs and a cute little lamb. All will be revealed. Hi, Linda.
Hello, good morning.
Hi. Thank you. Yes, it's morning.
Good evening for you.
Yes, good morning to you. Good evening. So, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. Let me put this in context. I saw my husband, our husbands work together, Linda's husband and my husband work together. And not geographically together, but they do work together. And Mr. Dogcast showed me a video of Linda with dogs and cats and a lamb. And it was just the most beautiful, wholesome thing I think I've ever seen. And I was just like, she is a kindred spirit. I have to talk to this lady. And I was saying to Mr. Dogcast, please, please, please put me in touch, put me in touch. So he did. He made contact. And then it turned out that Linda is an expert on guardian livestock dog breeds. I'm trying to remember everything. And Maremma sheepdogs. You're an expert on too many things for me to remember. So... But I mean, basically, cut to the chase for me, please. We'll get to your expertise and the studies and the science, which I love as well. But let's talk about the lamb, Nala. How did you end up with a lamb in your kitchen?
Well, one day, look, we live quite rurally here. So yeah. We're on the property. And it's, I suppose, for this part of the world, it counts as a little bit remote. So there's only like a dirt road to get to our place. And the dirt road is a public road, but it goes through other people's properties. And as a result, to stop livestock from going from one paddock into the other, just walking on the road, they put cattle breeds on the road just to stop the livestock. So one evening I was driving along that road on my way into town, and I came onto one of these cattle breeds. And it just, something was just off, because as I approached the cattle breed, the little lamb head was sticking out of the cattle breed. And I thought, that's not right. So I stopped the car and I went and looked. And yeah, sure enough, this tiny little lamb had fallen into the cattle breed.
Oh, bless.
And she couldn't get out, because obviously they're quite deep and she was only tiny. And she was just big enough that she could, when she was standing up, she could stick her head out and she could look around. But she couldn't get out by herself. So I managed to, with a bit of effort, wrangle her out of the cattle breed.
Yeah.
And then I started looking around to see that, well, surely there must be a mum around somewhere. But there wasn't a sheep inside. Nothing. So I did know that one of the paddocks on one side of the cattle breed, I had seen sheep there before. So I went looking and I saw some sheep that were way, way in the distance. So I actually did end up walking most of that distance, stopping short because I didn't want to scare the sheep away. And I put her down and I kind of just tapped her bum a little bit to make her call. And she did. She screamed her little head off. And I stepped back to see if any of the ewes would respond and come back and claim her. But nobody did. And I stood there for quite a while, just waiting to see what would happen. But in the end, the little lamb gave up and she found this tussock of grass and just lay against it and just went quiet. And it was starting to get dark. And this part of the world, we're in winter and the nights are really cold. It's usually below zero at night. So I didn't dare leave her there because she was so tiny at that point in time. She would not have made it through the night by herself. That's how I ended up with a little lamb.
Yeah, she is so lucky that somebody with such a big heart found her, because, you know, a lot of us would have seen it and gone, oh, that's very sad. I wish I could do something. But you actually did something, didn't you?
Well, the thing is, if I'd driven over that cattle grid, I would have squished her head. I really didn't want to do that.
No. Oh, bless her. When you took her home, she wasn't then the only animal in the house, was she?
No, we've got a few ourselves. Well, to clarify, we do have a couple of sheep too, which are kind of like just lawn mowers, pet sheep.
Yeah.
But they're adults, obviously. They're in a little paddock just at the side of the house here. But yeah, we've got cats, dogs, a few pet sheep, horses. What else do we got? We've got a few birds.
Oh, wow.
A few things.
I love your house. It sounds wonderful. If you were nearer, I would be pestering you all day long. Can I come over? Can I come over? You should be glad you're in Australia. You're safe from me. You're safe. But wow.
Oh, you'd be welcome to visit.
Oh, thank you. I wouldn't have to fall in the cattle grid. You guys could just come over.
No, you can just come over.
Thank you. Oh, bless.
Otherwise, I'll pull you out.
So, but I mean, the dogs. No, because we have two very, very small dogs. But your dogs aren't small, are they?
No, they're all big dogs.
Yeah.
They're all.
Oh, I guess they're
quite all over 25 kilos, I guess.
Yeah. Wow. I guess they're used to the sheep with I mean, can they interact with your adult sheep?
They can.
Yeah.
Usually there's a fence in between them, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have one dedicated livestock guardian dog. He actually lives with the sheep.
Yeah.
Not full time, depending a bit on the situation, but he does spend a lot of time actually living with the sheep. That's his job. His home, his territory. So he does. The other, it's generally a fence in between them. So they can interact with the sheep, but they don't. But yeah. They are used to them.
Yeah. It's amazing. So now, Nala, having lived with the dogs so long, she seems to think she's a dog, doesn't she?
Oh, she very much does. She doesn't want to have anything to do with my sheep. She doesn't know what they are. And she just looks at them and then just, she does her computer and just follows me again.
Oh, bless.
But she sees the dog, she'll just run to it. And she just loves dogs.
Oh,
and wherever the dogs go, that's where Nala just follows. Yeah. So yeah, she thinks she's a dog.
Oh, bless her. Now,
and it's even, I've got her, during the day she sits outside on the front deck in the front yard. At various times of the day, various dogs are out there with her. And if the dogs hear something and they'll just run off and start barking at it, she'll just happily run with them and just stand at the fence with them going, "What are we doing?" It's gorgeous.
Oh, bless her. How gorgeous. Wonderful. Now, just reassure us, because I'm sure some people will be wondering exactly what I was wondering. What's the future for Nala? I just need to know. She's not going to end up on a plate, is she? Just tell me that.
No, she's not. No. She'll be a pet sheep for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
She's going to go live with my sister. And my sister has two kids. She's actually Nala, actually one of three body lambs. There's two additional ones now as well.
Yeah.
So the three of them, we will put them all together, and they're going to form their own little flock, and they're going to be my sister's automatic lawn mowers.
Oh, bless. Does she have the sheepdog to go with them, though?
No, she doesn't. Wow. I've been trying to get her one, but she already has two dogs of her own, and I don't think she wants a third.
Oh, bless. I mean, we're only talking about a small dog. They're not a big dog. What are we talking about?
Well, she does have a border collie, so...
Oh, well, there you go.
I guess she's got the herding dog.
Yes. So they'll stay at home. They'll stay safe. But...
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that was fascinating. Thank you so much for that, because that's so cute. But so the dog that you're talking about that lives with your sheep is presumably a Maremma sheepdog?
He is not.
Oh, he's not? No. Okay,
We do have a Maremma.
Yeah.
And that's probably the dog you saw in the video. Big white fluffy dog.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that's my Maremma sheepdog.
Yeah.
She's more of a pet. Slash property guardian. She's great with livestock. She grew up with livestock, so she's really good with livestock. But she's my ambassador dog for my work.
Yeah.
So she comes with me when I attend farm and field days and I try to give people information about livestock guardian dogs. She comes with me and people can meet a Maremma. And sometimes I team up with a local farmer.
Yeah.
And they provide a couple of really tame sheep and a pen. then I provide the dog and we all stick them in together and people can kind of see the visual of a dog with livestock.
Yeah.
But she must be living inside though.
Some of the bigger dogs are little inside, aren't they? And they're just like, I'll sit on your lap and I'll cuddle. And conversely, some of the little dogs think, I'm a big dog, you better stand back.
That's right.
You've really surprised me there, because I thought if I said to you, would a Merema make a good pet dog? I thought you'd say, no, these are working dogs.
No, they don't.
Yeah. Oh, they don't?
I'm still going to say that.
Yeah, okay. So how do you occupy your dog then?
My dog? Well, yeah. I'm on a property to start with.
Yeah.
We've got 110 acres.
Yeah.
So she's got plenty of space to run around in.
Yeah.
She can still do her job because we've got a big yard. We've got the sheep right next to the yard. A lot of the time she's in the yard. That's her own choice. And she can just run around and bark and go nuts and just celebrate all the protective instincts she has.
Yeah.
Because I think my closest neighbor is like 5 kilometers down the road.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah. Nobody cares.
Just as well. Oh, well. So, I mean, my problem with today was where to start and then how to organize. There's so much to talk to you about. I know we're going to run out of time, but so Merema sheepdogs, and I'm just looking through my notes because you are a world standard expert on Meremas, aren't you? You've done huge amounts of research and you know about Meremas. So just tell us, a Merema sheepdog, what does it look like? What's its temperament like? What are they like?
Well, they're a livestock guardian dog. And I guess my research has been generally about livestock guardian dogs, but in Australia, historically, livestock guardian dog kind of means Merema sheepdog, because I think 95% of the working guardian dogs we have in this country, they're Merema.
Yeah.
So to look specifically at a Merema, they're a large breed. They usually weigh around 35, 40 kilos.
Yeah.
They're big, white, fluffy dogs. They look incredibly cute and fluffy, but yeah, they're pretty serious guardian dogs.
Yes, I imagine. I actually love that because being white, presumably they merge in to the flock. So your predator.
They do.
Yeah. So your predator mode would come down and think, oh, this is going to be easy pickings. And then from the flock emerges this big guardian dog going, not today, pal. Yeah. And it's like, yes.
Yeah. 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 I've got a couple of beautiful photos which farmers took and have passed on to me. And they're really just a flock of sheep.
Yeah.
And it's one of those search pictures. It's like spot the dog. Because all of those photos have at least one or two Meremas in there. But because they're similar size to the sheep, they're the same color as the sheep, you have to search to find them.
Yeah. It amazes me. And I know it's been over a long, you know, hundreds or thousands of years, but the fact that we, you know, whether we domesticated dogs or they domesticated themselves, however it happened, they became domesticated. And
yes.
And then we've harnessed those predatory instincts and kind of gone, you can chase or you can run after them, but we're going to then harness that. You're actually doing a job for me. You can't actually get that. You can't get the end of the chase. You know, you can look after them. And it seems amazing to me that they do this. But the Meremas, and I guess all the livestock guardian breeds, can actually live with the sheep or the livestock, whichever,
yes.
that and live with them. And they sort of live alongside them every day,
yes,
don't they?
Do.
Yeah.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Yeah, they're very different from like your herding breeds.
Yeah.
Like you say, like the herding breeds, like the Border Collies or the Kelpies here in Australia, you get a lot of Kelpies that are herding dogs. That's exactly right. We've harnessed that predatory instinct. And it's that whole hunting sequence that actually leads into the herding, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You've got the eye, and that's what a predator does too. When they're eyeing prey, you've got the stalk, which is exactly what a predator does, and the chase. And then the herding dogs are supposed to go up short, and they're not supposed to go for the bite. Some do, but usually that can be trained.
Yeah.
That they don't. But you're exactly right. It's that whole hunting sequence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas Meremas, or livestock guardian dogs in general, they are not supposed to have any of that. You'll never see a livestock guardian dog eye livestock, or they shouldn't be stalking or chasing them either.
Yeah.
And that's just thousands and thousands of years of selection.
Yeah, yeah. So they guard the sheep. We'll say sheep rather than keep saying sheep or livestock, whatever.
Yeah,
but the sheep.
Yeah.
They guard them, in essence. You know, they're it's, this is what intrigues me. You've got this big, fierce dog. Well, fierce may be the wrong word there, but I'm sure to the would-be predators, it's fierce. But it lives comfortably alongside them. But then I think some of the sharper, what we commonly refer to as sharper breeds, and I'm not going to name any breeds, but I've seen what people would think of as a guarding sharper breed, cry like a baby when their person or one of their people has gone off into the cafe to get the meal. And you think, but that's where that protection comes from. You only protect what you love, value, whatever you want to say it. I'm going to say love.
Yep.
But you only protect what you love, don't you?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. And that's what the whole system with these dogs are based on too, when they're working with livestock. Because to get them to that stage that they actually, that they guard the stock and they'll really protect them, they're raised with that livestock from the time they were really small up. And then, of course, they grow up with, let's say, sheep. From the time they're a tiny little pup, they're kept with sheep, they're raised with sheep. Sheep is pretty much their whole world. And they're their social companions, they're their buddies. Yeah. And of course, they're still a dog, so of course they're going to protect their buddies.
Yeah.
And that's the whole system's based on.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, obviously, I've been looking up about you online a little bit to prepare. And and one of the things that I read, and you'll have to correct me if I've got this wrong, but it's not, it isn't just a case, is it, of taking the puppy and sort of putting it with the sheep and going, there you go, do your job. It is no. So yeah. What does it actually involve then?
Well, what we do here in Australia, and what I always recommend people do, is you get your little puppy when it's ready to leave mum. You take it home and you create a little pen. A little pen, and you just add a few or very gentle livestock, because obviously you don't want that puppy to have any bad experience with the stock.
Mm.
So you're not going to put an aggressive ram in with the puppy. So you get maybe some really friendly ewes or maybe some putty lambs. That would work really well if you have them available. And it's only a small area, maybe 4 by 4 meters.
Yeah.
And you put the puppy in with the livestock, and that's where the puppy lives. So the puppy doesn't come inside and live in the house, or it doesn't come and live on your back deck. It's in the pen with the livestock. And of course you need to go visit it. You need to look after it. You need to feed it. You need to make sure it's okay. But that primary attachment of that pup needs to be with the livestock, not with the owner.
Yeah.
So then as that puppy grows and matures, obviously it can't stay in that tiny pen forever. So you just slowly increase the size of the area that the pup is kept in. You slowly increase the number of livestock that it's kept with. As it matures, and both physically and mentally, eventually it can also handle more difficult stock. And you just gradually keep going and increasing and adding until they're automatic and doing their job.
Wow.
And that's a very simplified way of putting it.
Yeah. So the dogs, when they protect the herd, they're acting instinctively? Like, is that trained or is that instinctive?
That's instinctive.
Yeah.
As the owner, you don't have to sit there teaching your dogs how to protect the herd. It seems to flow on automatically from that connection that they get to their flock.
Yeah.
It's the same with pet dogs. Like, if you get a German Shepherd, and that German Shepherd is a pet, and it creates that bond and that attachment to its family, then as that dog matures, usually around about puberty or a little bit later, it'll become protective of that family.
Yeah.
Because that family, it's back, really.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what it belongs to.
Yeah.
And that's the same with these dogs, except their family and their pack is the group of livestock they're with.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and they're their buddies, so they're going to protect them.
Yeah, yeah. So if you, I mean, because presumably sometimes you have more than one Maremma or one dog living with the pack. So But they generally get on well with other dogs as well, do they? Well, other guardian livestock dogs?
They seem to.
Yeah.
Especially, well, look, there are situations they don't.
Yeah.
And that's why I always tell people to have their dogs de-sexed.
Yes. Yeah.
Because two intact males can be a bit of an issue together. Two intact females can be a bit of an issue together. Generally, if you just get everybody de-sexed, there are no problems.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, if you add a puppy to an existing pack, there are no problems. Sometimes if you have an existing pack and you add already mature dogs, there can be some tension. But there's ways of managing that too. But yeah, I always tell people just get everybody de-sexed and otherwise get a male-female pair. But yeah. Then, of course, if they're not de-sexed, you're going to have to be really careful that you don't get unwanted litters.
Yeah, yeah. You don't have a flock of dogs then.
Yeah, that's right. You end up with 100.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned tension there, sort of the tension between the dogs. But one of the advantages of having the dogs, the livestock guardian dogs, is that it seems to me you take a lot of the tension out of the situation, because obviously the dogs are living the life that they have been bred to instinctively, you know, do and enjoy. You've got the livestock themselves presumably are less stressed because they've got protection living with them, and the farmers must be less stressed as well. So it really helps everybody, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
The whole stress in livestock aspect, I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
If I ever get funding for it, I'd like to really get to the bottom of that, because it's all anecdotal at this point.
Yeah.
There's no hard evidence to prove that that's happening.
Yeah.
But many farmers that I've spoken to have told me that, well, the sheep are always really flighty, and yeah, we got predator attacks, and that made them even more flighty. And we had all these breaks in the wool come shearing time, and they weren't growing so well. And yeah, after we got the Maremmas, everybody just calmed down, yeah. And everybody just settled. And they're so much easier to handle now.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating. Mm. And I'd love at some stage to actually put some hard figures on that and prove that, look, before, after, and this is actually what the difference is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't gotten there yet. But there's certainly plenty of anecdotal evidence to show that that's definitely happening.
Yeah. It's like, you know, the sheep are like, see my big brother over there. He'll deal with
you. Right.
Yes. The bouncer's on today.
Yeah.
I love it.
And it's also really interesting because, I mean, I've gone to a lot of properties where they have livestock guardian dogs. And it's fascinating because these dogs... And it's the whole interaction between the sheep and the dogs, because if there is a threat, it's not only the dog that will run forward to back at it, but it's also all the sheep that respond and all gather behind the dog.
Oh, wow.
And they go, okay, you go deal with it.
Yeah. I mean, bless it. It must give them peace of mind. And I think sometimes we underestimate sheep animals, you know, farm animals. Farm animals. Because and for a lot of people, they eat them, and that's that. They're a farm animal, that's all there. But when we were on a relative's farm and their Jack Russell arrived, well, somebody was visiting, their Jack Russell arrived, the cows put their calves in the middle and formed a ring and were just like, mm-mm, you know. And I was like, and it just, you know, a light bulb went off, and you went, oh, my goodness, these animals sort of, yes, they're farm animals, but they have instincts and brains and thoughts.
Yeah, of course they do.
Yeah. Amazing.
And look, the domesticated animals might not be quite at the same level as the wild ones are in that regard, but they still have brains and they still have instincts and they still know what they're doing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've got one eye, as ever, on the time, but let's talk then about some wild animals. I'm looking at my notes because I want to get this right. Eastern barred bandicoots. Now, the only thing I have to do with bandicoots is Crash Bandicoot, which is a computer game, a video game.
Okay. I'm not familiar with that one.
No, it's probably about 30 years out of date, but there you go. I don't know.
That's all right.
Yeah. So, but tell me about, because you tell me about the Eastern barred bandicoots, please, and the Maremmas.
Yes. Yeah. So in Australia, we got a little native animal called the bandicoot, and there's a couple of different species of bandicoot, and the eastern barred bandicoot is one of them. They're roughly the size of a rabbit, to give you some idea.
Yeah.
So they're not very big. They are quite important in the ecosystem because they've got quite a long snout, a long nose, and they go digging in the soil. And they turn a lot of soil over and it aerates the soil, which from an ecological perspective is quite important.
Yeah.
And they do it because they're looking for insects, other stuff, truffles. That's another real thing they dig for, little fungi that are growing underground. But long story short, they dig and it's really important for soil health. Now, the eastern barred bandicoot is a species that's in a little bit of trouble.
Yeah.
It is extinct in the wild on mainland Australia.
Yeah.
It still exists in Tasmania. It's doing okay in Tasmania, in the wild as well. But on mainland Australia, it only persists in captivity or in, I suppose, fenced nature reserves.
Yeah.
And the thought is that the main threatening processes for this little animal is, habitat destruction to us.
Yeah.
With livestock and deforestation, things like that. But also, once that happens and all that disturbance to the landscape takes place, then introduced foxes and introduced cats come in, and they exert quite a high level of predation on those populations, and they just have not been able to cope with it. The combination of the disturbance plus predation from an introduced predator that they couldn't manage. So I was involved in a project where we tried to reintroduce eastern barred bandicoots on a couple of locations, and we gave them Maruma sheepdogs to guard them from the predators.
Yeah.
And this was in Western Victoria.
Yeah. It's amazing. So, but you see, you make it sound so easy. We gave them Maruma sheepdogs to guard them. How?
Wasn't quite that easy.
Yeah. How do you get the Maruma sheepdogs and the bandicoots to understand this is your family now?
We didn't.
Yeah. So how does it work then?
Well, we had two reintroduction sites. And to start with, we put a fence around the sites, which prevented most bandicoots from exiting.
Yeah.
So we knew if we put a bandicoot on that site, they can't get out, theoretically. There's probably exceptions that are really tiny little small ones. If they were very young still, they could have escaped. But generally speaking, they were stuck. They had a fence. They couldn't leave. So we knew the bandicoots had to stay there. The fences were also good enough that the marimas could not leave. Again, if they had really, really wanted to, they might have been able to jump it. But, I mean, unlike some of the other livestock guardian dog breeds, the Maruma sheepdogs in Australia tend not to jump fences.
Yeah.
They go under, they go through, but they won't really jump, which is fantastic. So we knew that once we stuck them in there, that neither species could leave. So what we did is the Marumas were bonded to sheep. We added sheep to the site so the dogs had company and the dogs had a job because they were guarding the sheep. And by the presence of the dogs within the site, we were hoping that would be enough to protect the bandicoots that shared the same area. Now, we went one step further because we wanted to make absolutely sure that those dogs would never, ever even think about harming a bandicoot, even accidentally. So we trained the marimas to avoid the bandicoots as well, or at least to get them familiar with them, get them used to the smell, get them used to the sight of a bandicoot. And we told them that if they saw a bandicoot, they had to turn away and just leave it alone.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. And look, that in again, it sounds very easy. It was a little complicated to actually get to that stage, but we got there. That's the main thing.
Yeah.
And then we had the dogs on site probably for a good 6 months. Just with the sheep, and then we added the baby goods.
Yeah, and did it work?
It did and it didn't.
Yeah.
We, through the research I did, I showed very strong effects of the presence of the marimas on the fox population in the area. because we didn't have many feral cats on those two sites. So we kind of ignored the cats, couldn't get enough data. But we had a healthy fox population, so that's what we focused on. There was a very, very strong effect of the Maremma sheepdogs on the foxes. And the foxes very much avoided the areas where the Marammas were, which was fantastic. And that was the basis that we decided to go forward and introduce the bandicoots. Oh, I've got a little visitor here.
Oh, one of your lovely cats, bless. I've just got one eye on the time again. You have been fascinating and wonderful. I'd love to talk to you again, you know, one day soon, whatever, whenever you can fit me in. I would love to talk to you again, please. Please, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much, Linda. We've literally got 4 minutes. Is there anything else that you is there anything else you'd like to say quite quickly?
I don't know, I could probably talk for another 6 hours.
I know, me too. I could talk with you. If you send me some links, I normally now say, tell me some links, but if you send me some links, I will put the links on for people so they can come and find out more about you, because it's fascinating. I know people will be, wanting to find out more. It's just excellent. Thank you so much. I mean, all the best to your dogs, your cats, your lambs, your sheep.
Thank you.
And it sounds like there's so much work, research still to be done to find out the extent of how much these dogs can help us.
Yes. Oh, there definitely is. Yeah. There's, the more I get to know about them and the more I find out, the more fascinated I am and the more I want to know and find out. So I don't think I'll ever run out of research.
I hope Linda doesn't run out of research inspiration, because then I can keep interviewing her. I really enjoyed that, and we have all the links you need that we didn't have time for to fit into that interview at dogcastradio.com. I have to say that Dogcast Radio has been the perfect excuse for me over the years to talk to fascinating people, and I've been so grateful for all the opportunities it's given me over the 20 years we've been podcasting. Our next episode will be a celebration of those 20 years. But before I go and get on with editing that for you, I promise you 5 dog stories in 5 minutes, so synchronise watches and go. We start with the kind of story we love here at Dogcast Radio, a happy ever after. But as we know by now, these stories often have a sad first act. So, as the curtain goes up, we have a sad scene before us of a man in Tulsa, Oklahoma, bereft as his dog, Cowboy, has gone missing, and there's no sign of him after a month of searching, putting up posters and scouring the internet. But prepare yourself for Act 2 and let your spirits lift with the news that as the man is searching online, he spots a dog on a fairly local adoption event that looks strikingly similar to his lost dog. A quick scene change now as we turn our attention to Jenks Animal Welfare, a shelter bustling with activity as they welcome visitors and strive to match them with their forever pet. Enter our valiant, though heartbroken, hero, who strides in only to discover the dog he saw online was indeed his very own Cowboy. Cue applause, bring on the bouquets and clap the curtain calls. And let's not forget the moral of the story, which is to microchip your pets and keep your contact details up to date. Story number 2 takes us to Brazil, where Lee Stevens, an American woman, has moved to live with her husband, Gabriel Santos. A more promising opening to this story, isn't it? As we already have a happy love interest. But the slight problem here is that Lee is struggling to get to grips with the Portuguese language. But all, well, most things are happiness, flowers and chocolates. And our happy couple hear the patter of small feet when they adopt Billy, a street dog from a local shelter. Lee sets about training her dog straight away, but he steadfastly ignores all her attempts to communicate with him until, that is, she started speaking Portuguese to him. Now, there's no magic wand in dog training, but it turns out that speaking the language in which the dog knows commands and comments is a really, really good move. You can see for yourself the magical effect of using the familiar words in the TikTok video Lee posted. And there's a link to that waiting for you at dogcastradio.com. Not only is Billy now able to understand his new mistress, but Lee has the best motivation to rise to the challenge of learning Portuguese. Oh, it's just like Love Actually, isn't it, where Colin Firth learns Portuguese to propose to the girl he loves. I bet Richard Curtis wishes he'd have thought of motivating that character with the love of a dog instead. Oh, it could have been a very different and better, in my humble opinion, film for the inclusion of a dog story. However, I digress, and we must push on. Did you know training your dog can be a day at the beach? Literally. Ben McFarland, an expert from Acme Kennels, has shared his top tips for keeping your dog under control at the beach. Ben said, beaches may seem like paradise, but for dogs, they're full of distractions, crashing waves, circling seagulls, and tempting delicious scents. A strong whistle recall is key to keeping them safe and under control at the beach, as off-lead freedom should only be given to well-trained dogs. While many dog owners master whistle training at home or in the garden, taking it beyond the fence line and to the coast will introduce a fresh set of challenges. End quote. Beaches can be a sensory overload for dogs with roaming children, other pets and wide open spaces, making it essential that dogs reliably respond to their owners for both safety and enjoyment. So here are those top tips for keeping control in coastal chaos. Number one, combating long distance drift. The expanse of a beach can tempt even the most obedient dogs to wander. A dog whistle cuts through the wind more reliably than a voice command, so a short series of sharp pips, for example, three quick blasts on the whistle, can be trained as a check-in or directional cue. This helps dogs stay within range and engaged, even if they're sprinting along the shoreline. Number two, sand-specific training tactics. Unlike grass, sand can affect traction and speed. Practice recall and stop commands specifically on sand so your dog adjusts to how they move and respond in that environment. Start near the dunes where distractions are fewer before moving closer to the water's edge. 3. Introducing water boundaries. If your dog enjoys a swim, introduce a distinct whistle cue to recall them from the water. This may require a stronger reward, perhaps a special treat or their favourite toy, to entice them back from a paddle. It also teaches them that coming back doesn't mean the fun is over, but rather that it continues under your direction. 4. Navigating other beachgoers. Unlike fenced dog parks, beaches are shared with sunbathers, children, and other pets. Use your whistle to signal polite pauses, redirect your dog from approaching others uninvited, or call them to heel when navigating crowds. This makes your dog a welcome guest on any shoreline and reduces stress for everyone. For more information and training tips, visit Acme Kennels. And of course, you can find all the links you need at altogethernowdogcastradio.com. Get ready to curtsy now as we turn to Queen Camilla's visit to Battersea to open a new dog garden. To mark her first visit to Battersea's London Centre since 2016, Her Majesty was greeted by a very special guard of honour featuring Battersea dogs Bertie, Phoenix, Bella and Dipsy, as well as the charity's staff, volunteers and supporters. During her visit, the Queen received a special tour of the new dog garden, accompanied by Battersea's chief executive, Peter Lorry, and lead horticulturalist, Dawn Richards, who explained how this garden would be used as a special space for dogs to play, train, exercise, or simply snooze in the shade. Battersea dogs, Olive and Myrtle, were more than happy to take the garden for a test run and play a quick game of fetch with their special guest. The dog garden, designed by Monty Don and Jamie Butterworth, had originally been created for the Chelsea Flower Show before being kindly donated by the Royal Horticultural Society and BBC Radio 2 to Battersea to live on at their London Centre. Once Her Majesty had spoken with Battersea gardening volunteers, Monty Don and others involved with the garden's development, she met with a range of the charity's supporters, including Battersea ambassadors Amanda Holden, David Gandy, Dame Jacqueline Wilson DBE, Sarah Fisher and Sue Perkins, before officially opening the dog garden and unveiling a plaque to commemorate the special day. Her Majesty has a personal connection with Battersea, having rehomed three of their dogs, Beth in August 2011, Bluebell in September 2012 and Molly in 2025. Sadly, Her Majesty had to say goodbye to Beth in November 2024 when her beloved pet passed away. The new garden will be one of many spaces at Battersea's London Centre where staff and volunteers can spend time with the thousands of dogs that come through the charity's gates each year, many of which arrive at Battersea with challenging behavioural or medical issues that the charity's expert teams will then work on tirelessly. Last year, the charity took in 2,766 dogs and 2,454 cats at its three centres in London, Kent and Windsor, including 241 animals transferred from other rescues around the UK. Now, I know that Queen Camilla calls her dogs fur babies. Asterisk. I know nothing of the kind. I'm just trying to be entertaining and whimsical on a podcast. Cut me some slack. And if any royalty is listening, please, you cut me some slack and don't throw me in the Tower of London and throw away the key. Anyway, if you consider your dogs to be your fur babies, according to an article in the National Geographic, there is sound evolutionary reason for this, and I do love it when science backs up what we dog lovers already know. Again, I'll pop this link on the Dogcast Radio site for you to have a look at for yourself, because there's a lot of interesting information and research into this. But basically, as we domesticated dogs, or as they domesticated themselves, however it happened, the longer our association with dogs has endured, the more they have assumed the role of our babies, and the more we have thought of them as our babies, and the more our brains have been wired to think that way. So there you go. That's science. And you can't argue with science. Well, you can, but I'm not going to argue on that particular subject because I agree with it. And also, I don't have any time. My 5 stories and my 5 minutes are up. And please, don't check into whether I actually hit the 5-minute mark. Let's just assume I did. We're friends, aren't we? Until next time, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. The sheepdog says to the farmer, "Here are your 20 sheep." The farmer says, "I only have 17 sheep." "I know," replies the sheepdog. "I rounded them up."